Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 10 Republican candidates for president on the stage last night in Boulder, Colorado, for the third GOP debate. The economy was the announced topic, the moderators got grilled, and the contenders, in between their swipes at one another, told us a little about what they would try to do on taxes, spending, Social Security, and more. This hour on Point, the GOP debate number 3. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you hear on the economy and beyond the economy from the stage last night? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's dive in with three great observers right here. With us from New York, Rana Faruhar, Assistant Managing Editor in charge of Economics and Business for Time Magazine. Rana, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Great to have you here. From Washington, Megan McArdle joins us, Bloomberg View columnist who writes on economics, business, public policy. Megan McArdle, welcome. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
And from Washington, Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Let's go straight to Ted Cruz's big attack on the whole forum of the night. He didn't like the questions, got one of the biggest rounds of applause from the Republican crowd there when he went at the moderators.
This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
Ted Cruz laying it down right there, and you can hear the crowd loved it. Attacking the mainstream media is a crowd pleaser, but last night it went over particularly well. We'll look at the substance of what got out there last night and what lies behind the comments we heard from the stage. But Rachel, just come in for us first on the who won, who lost dynamics of last night. How did you see the lineup faring on the stage in Boulder?
The quote you went to was exactly the right soundbite to start with. The media were the big losers last night, and particularly CNBC. A really difficult debate for them. We just heard the line from Ted Cruz that got so much applause last night. Senator Marco Rubio, who had a great night last night, also went after the media very effectively, as did Donald Trump and others. So definitely the people who got pounded most in that debate were the media. Great night, as I said, for Marco Rubio. He has done well in all the debates, had a particularly excellent night last night, really put him in the spotlight, and we'll see how he capitalizes on that. He had an exchange with Jeb Bush that was one of the most memorable moments of the night. Bush had a really bad night. The two big losers of the night, the media, CNBC especially, and Jeb Bush. Bush tried to take on Marco Rubio by pointing out that he'd missed a lot of Senate votes. This is becoming an issue in Marco Rubio's campaign, at least something that critics are trying to make an issue for Marco Rubio. So Bush went after him for missing votes. It was the most intense exchange of the cycle between the two men, trying to say, Marco, when you sign up for this, this was a six-year term, you should be showing up to work. And Bush went on to say, what is this, like a French work week? So trying to
but it didn't have much pop in. Somehow last night.
The had no
went
pop
over like
at
a,
all.
Like
and,
a
and
what?
Rubio...
Like a stale croissant.
Like a block of granite.
There you go.
Yes.
There you go.
Like a block
and Rubio
of granite.
Fired back very effectively.
Yes,
so
he
what
did.
Started as a moment where Bush was really trying to assert himself, he ended up looking extremely flat. And Rubio won that exchange. He fired back very effectively and said that Bush had never taken issue with Senator McCain missing votes when he was running for president. He said, the only reason you're doing it now is because we're running for the same position. So really got the upper hand in that exchange, and that set the tone for both men for the entire night.
Ben Carson and Donald Trump went in number 1 and 2 in some polls last night. Let's listen to just a little bit of them. We'll come back in, but here was Ben Carson talking about government subsidies, how he would run the economy, the government.
The best policy is to get rid of all government subsidies and get the government out of our lives and let people rise and fall based on how good they are.
A little Carson philosophy there, and Donald Trump couldn't help but boast about how well he's done on a pretty small personal investment in the campaign, he said so far. How great would it be if all of America could do that well?
So far, I put up less than anybody, and I have the best results. Wouldn't that be nice if the country could do that?
Megan McArdle, what about the two front runners who have so upset the Republican, elite, the sort of old guard with their big performance here? But they've had a lot of support. Now we're on the economy. Should be Donald Trump's strong suit. I don't know about Ben Carson. What did you see in these, sort of breakout leaders in this campaign so far, Megan?
Well, I mean, I think a shocking lack of preparedness on Ben Carson's part to start with. He sounded
just
as
drifting
if
up there.
He really sounded as if he was reading what his policy points off of like a blurry photocopy and had forgotten his glasses that he'd just seen. He was talking like kind of like an eighth grader trying to explain something they don't really understand very well. And I'm not saying that Ben Carson is stupid. He's emphatically not a stupid man at all. But clearly, the level of policy preparedness that he has to discuss this stuff is much lower than other candidates who have been doing this for a while. Meanwhile, you have Donald Trump, who also doesn't talk about policy in any serious way. But, I'm not sure it matters. And I came out of this thinking, look, I would not, I would want Ben Carson. I would totally let him babysit my dog at any point. I would be happy to have him operate on me.
Are you just being another snarky mainstream media member, Megan?
I am being another snarky mainstream media person.
We're going to have to play that Ted Cruz quote again.
Well, no, yes. Look, in fact, I actually think that Cruz had a point. I actually think he had two points. And the first is that on a lot of questions, Democrats do get Republicans do get asked harder questions than Democrats do. I mean, like, this was supposed to be the economy debate. Why are we hearing about Ben Carson's views on gay marriage? Why? Because the moderators wanted to make this debate about them. They were not looking to elicit good points, the kind of substantive debate about the economy that we saw at the Democratic debate. What they were trying to do was score points off of the Republicans so that they would look and they failed miserably at this. It was appalling at one point. Now, in fairness, the Republicans had adopted a novel strategy of simply denying things that they had, in fact,
yes,
said
indeed,
and done.
Indeed, again and again.
But, the moderator at one point, one of the moderators said, well, then where did I get that? Why do I think that? Well,
don't ask them. That's your job.
Ask the question,
we're going
right?
to have John Harwood with us in this hour tomorrow. We can our listeners can put to him what they thought of the debate and how he thought it all went. Rana Faruhar, what about on the merits? When we managed to really get into the economy, what were you hearing from that stage?
Well, not a lot of substance. I have to agree with Megan. For a debate that was really supposed to be about economic and financial issues, there was just so little to chew on, and much of what we heard was just false. I mean, if you can start with the tax plans, the fact that, all of the candidates were saying that their tax plans were going to reduce the deficit. Well, the Conservative Tax Foundation has said that all of them, with the exception of Rand Paul's, would balloon the deficit. And Rand Paul's, they're only bullish on because they have, I think, extremely over-optimistic projections about what cutting taxes on Wall Street would do for the economy. So there's that. There's also this sense that the Republicans just haven't moved beyond the sort of trickle-down, conservative ideas about what cutting taxes do for economic growth. And, the last 20 years have shown us that cutting taxes doesn't necessarily create economic growth. If you look back, Bill Clinton actually raised taxes in 1993. He got great growth. George W. Bush lowered them in 2001 and in 2003, and he got meager growth. And, same again during the Obama administration. So this idea that the Republicans keep pushing that you just lower taxes and growth comes, I just think most Americans aren't buying it anymore. And then there were some just flat out mistakes. Marco Rubio was saying people are struggling with higher prices. Well, we have hardly any inflation in the economy. So lots of fact checking errors.
Interesting how the distribution of income inequality, did come up from the stage. Mike Huckabee, no less. Ted Cruz talked about it a little bit. Here was Huckabee expressing concern over income inequality in the USA.
Corporations ought to exercise some responsibility. When CEO income has risen 90% above the average worker, when the bottom 90% of this country's economy has had stagnant wages for the past 40 years, somebody is taking it in the teeth. And it's not the folks on Wall Street.
Megan McArdle, there you had Huckabee. You also had Cruz. You had others alluding to the problem with distribution of income and wealth in this country on a Republican debate stage. But in the substance of their plans, do you see in any of them, or call one or two out if you've got them, something that would take that on, that might address that inequality?
Look, you know, I think that this is interesting because this is actually these talking points are somewhat contested by economists as to exactly how inequality has evolved. You know, not that it's obviously gotten worse. Has it gotten as much worse as Mike Huckabee said? It's not clear.
I mean, you had Ted Cruz quoting Emmanuel Saez up there last night on this. He's ready to go with it. So, OK,
but
you can hold out if you like.
The truth is that people feel insecure. And I actually think that that often has less to do with inequality than with other issues about things like job opportunities, labor market stability and so forth. But inequality is a convenient shorthand to discuss that. And I think that there is a feeling that the system is rigged, that and interestingly, I think that's also what Cruz was channeling, is that, you know, one of the reasons, the mystery of why Donald Trump does so well is that he says things that are kind of objectively crazy. He is in no way
crazy. He'll make America great again. What's crazy about that?
Well, right. The Mexican wall, the Mexican president exporting his rapist population to the United States. He's going to get Mexico to pay the wall that we're going to build.
I'm sure they're writing the check right now.
Exactly. Well, my feeling is that maybe he wants to borrow the money from Mexico and then go bankrupt, which would, in fact, make them pay for it.
Ouch.
But, you know, there is a real sense that the system is rigged and that Ted Cruz also is playing to that same perception in the base, that the media has control and they are shushing. You know, that people are tired of being shushed by their self-appointed betters. And that is why those sorts of comments do so well with the Republican base. They feel like they have no control over this media elite that tells them what they think, that calls them racist when they oppose immigration. And Donald Trump is the guy, with Ted Cruz as a close second, who channels that anger.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the Republicans' debate number 3 in Boulder, Colorado last night on the economy and more, looking at who's up, who's down, and what they're really saying on taxes, spending, policy, and how the pie will be divided in this country. Rachel Smolkin is with us, executive editor of CNN Politics. Megan McArdle, Bloomberg View columnist, is here. Rana Faruhar from Time Magazine. And you can join us. What do you think of the main thrust of the economic philosophy on that stage last night? Where would these contenders take the U.S. economy? Are you with Huckabee, protect Social Security all the way, or with Christie, we've got to cut it, got to get real? Is Carly Fiorina right? Put the tax code on 3 pages. Is Ted Cruz right? Eliminate the IRS. Or Rand Paul right? That the establishment in Washington is driving us into the ground with its budget deal. Rachel, Megan, Rana, right out of the gates last night, they asked, what's your weakness? It's kind of an easy question to get somebody squirming. John Kasich, far left, not in the center, as Donald Trump would point out at all, but he came right out of the gates, ignored the question, and basically saying to the audience in the hall and beyond, a bunch of these guys up here are not cut out for this job. You'll hear him talking about Medicare and Medicaid and deporting 10. He says 10 or 11. He means 10 or 11 million. Donald Trump's line. Here's Kasich right out of the gate and really tough on others on the stage.
My great concern is that we are on the verge, perhaps, of picking someone who cannot do this job. I've watched to see people say that we should dismantle Medicare and Medicaid and leave our senior citizens out in the cold. I've heard them talk about deporting 10 or 11 people here from this country, out of this country, splitting families. I've heard about tax schemes that don't add up, that put our kids in a deeper hole than they are today. We need somebody who can lead. We need somebody who can balance budgets, cut taxes.
Governor?
And, you know, frankly, I did it in Washington, in Ohio, and I will do it again in Washington if I'm president.
John Kasich comes out swinging. Megan McArdle, you may be our most, sort of libertarian, sympathetic to the policies up there. Is there a bunch of Looney Tunes stuff on the stage? Is he right about that? Or is he the crazy uncle and actually there's some good ideas up there?
Well, there are good ideas up there, and there's a lot of crazy, too.
Okay.
And to some extent, I want to be fair, this is somewhat par for the course for an election, right? Like, you had Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton going around promising that they could pay for huge new spending, and all they were going to have to do was raise taxes on a handful of rich people. Well, the European-style welfare states that they like tax the middle class really heavily to pay for them because you have to. There's not enough money with the rich. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the Republicans, their fantasy is that you can cut taxes. You can have an American-style welfare state. And you can cut taxes, not pay for, you know, pay for it with no taxes at all. And this is equally, if not crazier, because they come up with these numbers that are totally ludicrous. You know, Ben Carson wrote a 15% flat tax. No, we're not going to have a 15% flat tax, Ben Carson. You couldn't possibly pay for this stuff that you aren't willing to cut, like Social Security and Medicare. And yes, people were actually, I thought that the entitlement reform debate was the most substantive discussion that we've had on this issue on a debate stage in a long time.
You're talking Social Security, Chris Christie?
Social Security, yes. Mm-hmm. I was very pleased. Now, I would have liked it better if they had not said the money was stolen. I mean, this is, it doesn't matter where the money went, it's gone. And future taxpayers are going to have to pay these benefits. But that said, right, no one was proposing to slash Social Security and Medicare or not pay the interest on the national debt or cut the defense spending to the point that would be needed to balance the budgets on the taxes that a lot of them are proposing. And I think that on that point, Kasich was absolutely right. And then when you bring in Donald Trump, who makes all sorts of crazy promises.
He waves his hands and says, it's going to be fantastic.
It's going to be tremendous, fabulous, luxurious, and very classy, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yes.
that's basically his,
I mean, people
all of
respond
his
to that. They want that. You can see in his poll numbers that has not been an ineffective strategy. Rana, did you hear anything further from Trump last night on the substance of how he would make that happen?
No, not at all. I mean, I think, you know, he's never strong on substance, but he was particularly weak. And he didn't get as much time tonight, which I think, shows that, that he was sort of faltering. And, you know, it's interesting because Donald Trump is all about winning, right? I mean, that's his whole thing. And he has publicly said that if his support starts to falter, that he may pull out of the race. I mean, I expect that if the poll numbers go down, I don't think he's going to be in much longer.
You're
I just think
Jeb.
It's not his game. I'm talking about Trump.
Trump himself.
But I mean, Jeb's a whole nother.
Oh,
I mean,
okay,
I, you know,
okay.
I think
hang off on
his,
Jeb
his
then.
Perform-
you mean because if Donald's not winning, he doesn't want to be
that's
in the
right.
room.
He doesn't want to be in the room. That's his whole. That's psychologically. That's the kind of person he is. Jeb, I think, had also a very poor showing. Very disappointing. You know, even some of his supporters were saying that after the debate. I think one thing that was very interesting, though, in terms of not policy issues, but the tone. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk about fighting crony capitalism, fighting mm-hmm. this sort of vested interests between Wall Street and Washington. Carly Fiorina, in particular, had an interesting line about that. She was bashing, you know, big banks, big companies, big pharma, which made me sort of laugh because, frankly, when she was at HP, she made that company bigger by doing an enormous, very bad merger of the type that she was
yep.
decrying.
Yep.
But I thought it was interesting because in some ways, the reason that we have such a broad number of candidates right now in the Republican field is because people do feel that the game is rigged and they don't trust the traditional candidates. They don't trust the traditional interests and they want an outsider of some kind. They don't know quite who they want that to be, but they're ready for that, I think.
There was a new twist on GOP philosophy last night, at least to my ear, from Carly Fiorina. I want to listen to it for just a minute here. The former Hewlett-Packard CEO, she got her own grilling on that last night, but talking about how when government gets big, then companies get big. And I want to hear what you all think of it. Here was Carly Fiorina.
When government gets big and powerful, the big feel like they need to get even bigger to deal with all that power. And meanwhile, the small and the powerless, in this case, 1,590 community banks go out of business. You see, folks, this is how socialism starts. Government causes a problem, and then government steps in to solve the problem.
Megan McArdle, what do you make of socialism starts? I mean, we're talking about a concentration of power and wealth and fewer banks in many industries, consolidation. Do you see that as a mirror reflection of larger government? Does that add up to you?
Well, in a lot of ways, yes. Right.
Okay. Look, how's the dynamic work there?
Carly Fiorina, the specifics of what she said, I take issue with. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we are on the road to socialism. I also don't think
it's hard to see it with these giant corporations. I mean,
well, but actually, so I mean, you know, you look at what happened in Europe in a lot of places. The giant corporations, they get nationalized by the
they get cozy and okay, okay.
But also, it's more than that. It's this sense that look. You know, she is right that who benefits from big government? Big corporations. If you look at financial firms, if you look at firms in any number of industries, these guys basically have regulators camped out in their offices all the time. Mm-hmm. They have huge staffs of compliance people to make sure that they are in regulatory compliance. For small businesses, those challenges are incredibly daunting. They add expense. And it means that when you have a bigger government, those people obviously often, not always, are more effective at lobbying. It sort of depends on the industry. Community banks, for example, are very effective lobbyists. But they have the ability to deal with these regulations in a way that smaller businesses don't. And so the bigger the government, the more regulation there is, the bigger corporations are going to get. And that is, I think, a totally fair point. And it is a totally fair point about what we see in the United States, where as industries get more and more regulated, the temptations to consolidation are strong. Does that mean that you can explain the Walgreens and Rite Aid merger by saying it's all big government? No. But she is pointing up a real tendency, and I think a tendency that the Republican base, we are in a populist moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think on both
Main
sides.
Street feeling that. Yes, what's going on here? Rachel Smolkin, what works? What sells here? We heard smaller government a lot last night. It wasn't quite as simple as 4 or 8 or 12 years ago, cut the government, the economy will boom, because we just haven't necessarily seen that. What do you think is playing from the stage there? And does Carly have a new note in the symphony?
What's clearly playing is the anti-Washington rhetoric. The I am an outsider is big this year. So anyone who is not an outsider is really struggling anyway, either to portray themselves as an outsider or to portray themselves as the sober adult. You had mentioned John Kasich earlier when we were talking about entitlements, and that's exactly what he tried to do last night. He talked about getting rid of Medicare and Medicaid and said, come on, you scare senior citizens with that. It's not responsible. So he is looking for a lane and tried to portray himself as the adult in the room. That is not playing. We'll have to see what his poll numbers do after last night. He had a pretty strong night, but he tried to really inject his experience. He chaired the House Budget Committee. Mm-hmm. He shepherded a Midwestern swing state back into the black for the budget. And he is trying to say, look, I have the credentials and experience to do this. That's really not played so far in an election where the outsiders who have none of that experience are coming in and saying, Washington's ridiculous. We need to get big government out of our lives. It's been the season of Donald Trump and Ben Carson.
I mean, so, it was a gamble, but he kind of had to take a gamble. Of course, earlier
he
debates,
had to take a gamble.
But he looked like Steady Freddy before. And last night, you know, pushing it, you end up risking looking a little off kilter yourself, but he wouldn't let it up. Here's Kasich one more time, coming back to it, going after Trump's immigration plan, Ben Carson's tax plan. Here you go.
To talk about we're just going to have a 10% tithe and that's how we're going to fund the government, and we're going to just fix everything with waste, fraud, and abuse, or that we're just going to be great, or we're going to ship 10 million Americans or 10 million people out of this country, leaving their children here in this country and dividing families. Folks, we got to wake up. We cannot elect somebody that doesn't know how to do the job.
Kasich talking about others in a fantasy last night from the stage. But let's dive right in to where it got a little beefier. Well, I mean, that's beefy if you buy his line. But here was Chris Christie. He went at it with Mike Huckabee over Social Security, saying, and Christie's saying, look, it's in dire trouble. We got to level with the American people. And we're going to have to make cuts here. Here's Christie.
Let me be honest with the people who are watching at home. The government has lied to you and they have stolen from you. They told you that your Social Security money is in a trust fund. All that's in that trust fund is a pile of IOUs for money they've spent on something else a long time ago. And they've stolen from you because now they know they cannot pay these benefits because Social Security is going to be insolvent in 7 to 8 years.
Megan McArdle, 7 to 8 years insolvent. What do you say?
It depends on how you define insolvency. The Social Security Trust administrators, trustees, say that the money is going to run out in the 2030s. But you have to look at, there's multiple points at which things run out. It started when the inflows into the system fell below the outflows. That has already happened. The next inflection point is the point at which we're nominally paying our self-interest and with this complicated accounting. It's all, you know, if you net it all out, it's all taxpayer money that's going out in excess of the Social Security taxes that are collected. That will happen in the 2020s.
But he says we've got to cut, bring the age, push the age up, bring, I think, benefits down. You know, he wants to get in there, and he's saying it very clearly, get in there with a knife and do some cutting. Huckabee's saying no, no, no. Who's right?
Christie is. This is the overwhelming consensus of basically every person who analyzes this issue. We need to raise the retirement age, and we need to look at some sort of formula change, how the benefits are calculated, whether that is means testing, whether that is changing the inflator that you use to calculate the cost of living adjustments. Someone has to do something because, in fact, in the early 2030s, right around the time I am scheduled to retire, the system
so
is...
So you think.
Keep writing those books, Megan.
the system is theoretic, is going to... supposed to cut benefits by basically 25%.
So,
that's not obviously feasible, but with the problems we're going to have with Medicare as well, we're going to need to do something about these systems. That is, like, he is basically saying the consensus. Now, the way he said they stole the money is not the way that, you know, policy wants them to talk about it. But he's absolutely right on substance.
I mean, I think he had an interesting point. You know, he is right on substance. I totally agree with Megan's analysis of that. And no, I mean, it wasn't, the government didn't steal the money, but the government did spend money that might have just been left there because for some
this was
period
Al Gore's
of time, we were
thing,
taking in.
Don't let him get it out of the lockbox.
Well, but so,
don't let him get it out of the lockbox and spend it on the military. I mean, I think he was kind of hitting an important chord there.
The government doesn't save, right? The government doesn't have a 401k account. It doesn't have any. When Bush tried to set that sort of thing up, people got very upset. The government, the only thing the government can do if it takes money in excess of its spending, of the spending commitments on Social Security, the only thing it legally can do with the money is lend it to the general fund.
But here's the thing, Rana. You've got Mike Huckabee saying, do not touch it. There's a sacred commitment here. You've got Bernie Sanders saying, grow the benefits. Americans deserve more than this. And here's Chris Christie saying, bump the age up and bring the benefits down for those who can afford to go without. Who's right, Rana?
I think Christie is closest to being right. You know, I think that, you know, as Megan said, most people that analyze this issue agree that the system's got to be cut and reformed in that way. Bernie Sanders, it was interesting. He was also talking about how we should be Denmark, you know, which is a whole nother way of looking at this issue. I mean, if you raise taxes on the middle class, if you have a welfare state where you can pay for an incredibly cushy system and you actually invest in education, workforce training and all the things that make a country like that so dynamic, economically dynamic, then you can have a system where maybe you have richer benefits. But given our system, I think Christie's the closest to being right.
Rachel, we're going to come back and look at tax policy that proposed last night, but on benefits here, on Social Security. You're the political editor. Who's got the message that works in 2015, 2016? Mike Huckabee, don't touch it. Chris Christie, let's tell it like it is. We've got to get in there and make changes. What are Americans, Republicans that really matter here, ready for?
It's less substance than style so far this year. Not so much what the message is, at least so far, than how it's delivered. We were talking before about Donald Trump and Ben Carson, both of whom were surprisingly quiet in the debate last night. But again, that outsider that let's just hit Washington, Christie and his this is ridiculous style had a much better night in last night's debate than he has before. And I think his tough talk, no nonsense persona did resonate last night. So again, it's less the difference in the message. They're not that far apart in what they're telling
people.
Well,
aren't they? Huckabee and Christie sounded far apart.
They sounded far apart on some particulars, but overall message that we're seeing is really more about style, at least so far in this election. Maybe with a different debate, as Megan pointed out earlier, we would have gotten into more of those differences in substance.
Megan, do you see the populism that's out there pushing policy in a new direction? Or is it more of what we saw, you know, under George W. and what we saw promoted by Mitt Romney?
I think that in with Republicans, you were really seeing this crony capitalism
theme
talking point take off. And I think with good reason. Right. I mean, there is a fair amount of it in our country. And it's actually heartening to me to see Republicans looking for things beyond simply kind of crude supply-siderism. But that said, you know, no one has really quite defined what that means yet. They talk about crony capitalism. They want to fight it. What they don't say is, okay, what specific things other than not authorizing the Ex-Im Bank, which they just did.
Yes.
They don't
what
talk about
what whose ox would actually get gored among all those big, big players out there. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Republicans' debate number 3 on the economy and more, looking at who's up, who's down, and what they're really saying on taxes, spending, policy, Social Security, how the pie will be divided in this country. Rachel Smolkin is here, executive editor of CNN Politics. Megan McArdle is with us from Bloomberg View. Rana Faruhar from Time Magazine. Oh, great. In watching what we saw last night, you can join us as well. What do you think? Was it Rubio's night? Do Trump and Carson still have it? Whatever that it is Jeb Bush still in it? And what do you want to know on the merits, on the substance from last night? Lots of response online. Scott says the Republicans have zero room to complain about the system being rigged when they're the primary driving force behind rigging it, pushing things that ended up in Citizens United and unlimited campaign funding. Okay, but Jeb Bush has raised a lot of money, and he was not kicking tail exactly last night. Goderback says, I welcome the fairer tax proposals being offered by several of the Republican candidates, but they need to be paired with sensible federal government spending policies. Right now, listener says 50% of citizens paying no federal income tax. Let me check that. Tax policy is unfair, spending out of control. Rand Paul talking about that last night right here, saying that the new deal just done by the outgoing John Boehner in Congress will explode the deficit. Rand Paul.
The deficit will explode under this. This is the unholy alliance that people need to know about between right and left. Right and left are spending us into oblivion. We should use the debt ceiling as precisely designed to force upon them budgetary reform.
Hold that unholy alliance. A couple of callers right here. Brad in Essex, Iowa. Brad, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, I'm a registered independent here in Iowa, and I take my vote seriously. And
yep, good.
Last night, you know, I 2 points, really. The first is that the moderators, which you mentioned at the beginning, but your caller, your panel haven't really addressed yet, were beyond rude. They were to the point of unprofessional in their way that they were so snide in their presentation of the question and the substance of the questions themselves. And I would like to hear their thoughts on that. But
okay.
Second, I do believe 2 or 3 nails were driven into the campaign of Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is, I think this is going to be a real tipping point for him.
Why exactly, Brad? What did you see that makes you say that in Jeb?
His inability to handle Marco Rubio's response to him, his inability to deliver anything that sounded like a coherent, he doesn't even appear to want to be there. There was no passion.
No passion from Jeb Bush. I appreciate that very much, Brad. Rachel, hold Jeb Bush for a second, and let's go to the moderation of the debate. We've seen 3. We saw that sort of laser-focused Fox team early on. Then we saw, Anderson Cooper and the CNN with those sort of funny call-out questions, you know, a black man asking a black question, Latino, and so on. And then last night, how did it stack up, Rachel?
Well, there are 2 things going on here, and those are great points about the moderation. So 2 lines of attacks, 1 against the media in general, and of course attacking the so-called liberal media, very popular for the Republican base, especially in a primary. As a candidate, you can never go wrong in a primary with an attack on the media. And important to note that Democrats are also quite happy to attack the media. So that's point number 1. The second point is more specifically about CNBC and their handling of the debate, and they were widely panned. I mean, we saw Twitter erupting, and not just from Republicans, but also from more neutral observers. There were journalists weighing in. People were very surprised by the nature of the questions, by the tone. And the RNC chairman, Reince Priebus, came out after the debate absolutely swinging, blasted CNBC for what he called gotcha questions and said the network should be ashamed. So the strongest possible language from him, saying he was very disappointed in the moderators. I think you'll continue to see a blowback about that through the day and beyond. So that's point number one. Yeah. And, you know, the candidates clearly really frustrated. There were reports, one of our reporters, Maeve Reston, heard that a Bush advisor was pounding on the door to the control room in the middle of the debate. He was so frustrated by the questions and the lack of time, right? So this was in real time, the frustration that was playing out, and we will continue to see that play out.
Rana, is this just working the refs, this rage about the attitude of the questioners? You know, complain about the refs and maybe they'll back off on the calls?
There is certainly an element of that.
First of all, full disclosure, my own television affiliation is with CNN, so I'm not completely unbiased on this. But I do think that they had a point. I think that it was very snarky. But you know what? I mean, do you watch CNBC? It's snarky. Welcome to the Roller Derby, Jim Cramer. You know, I mean, that's what they go for. So I'm kind of surprised that anybody was surprised by that, frankly.
Megan, what about Rand Paul on the deal that's just been done in Congress, saying it will explode the deficit, unholy alliance between right and left? I mean, Rand Paul's got almost no traction, but is he right, wrong, or on his own moonbeam?
The budget deal was not very good, and I think that this is something that Republicans have complained about for a long time, which is that you get this, as you said, unholy alliance, where basically, Democrats want more spending, Republicans don't want taxes to go up that much, and like what's left is raising the deficit. And I think that that was something that you saw in the Bush years, you saw it in the Clinton years, less because obstreperous Republican congressmen sort of wouldn't let him spend more money. And that's something that the base really believes strongly, that Republicans need to hold this back, because if they let it go an inch, then you're going to get a deal where the deficit goes up, where more spending is done, and where that spending then can't be cut in the future. And so I think that he is right that the budget deal wasn't great. And I think that politically, he's also right that this is the sort of message that really resonates with the people he's trying to appeal to.
2013, 43% of Americans paid no federal income tax. To our listeners saying half, well, it's not quite half, but it's getting up there. Tahir in Wakefield, Massachusetts. Tahir, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What do you see?
I was going to comment on the whole retirement age, the what was talked about before with the Christie versus Huckabee.
Yes.
I kind of think they both got it a little bit wrong, because the whole idea that we're going to have this retirement age that applies to everybody, I think it's not good. It's not correct. So you can't say that 65 is the right age or 67 is the right age.
Well, you've got options about when you retire, but there's a minimum, and Christie says it's got to go up.
Yeah, I don't think there should be this minimum. Instead, we should go to, like, Australia has a private retirement account to fund both Medicare and Social Security with a transition period for current retirees. So people who paid into the system should get something out of that to the extent that they paid. But then people who are younger should be switched from that system to the private system, like a Fidelity, or I don't want to plug companies.
Yeah. There's
like
a lot of talk about that kind of thing last night as well. Tahir, I appreciate your call. I want to get to taxes, and maybe it's time to talk about Jeb Bush as well. I'll just leave aside the exchange with Marco Rubio over the time he spent actually voting or not voting, the votes that he missed. He missed a lot, but Rubio just slaughtered him on that, talking about all the other former candidates who missed as much or more than he did, and Jeb Bush didn't complain then. Jeb had really no response to that. Here was Jeb Bush on taxes.
The simple fact is that my plan actually gives the middle class the greatest break. $2,000 per family. And if you make $40,000 a year, a family of four, you don't pay any income tax at all. Simplifying the code and lowering rates, both for corporations and personal rates, is exactly what we need to do.
Megan, can you speak to the range of tax proposals on that stage last night, where they cluster and where the winners seem to be turning?
Look, you know, talking about whether a tax cut is more or less progressive is actually a lot harder than it sounds. You would think it's easy. Is it better for the rich or for the poor?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Bush tax cuts, for example, were much more progressive in the technical economic sense, which is the percentage. They changed the distribution of who paid taxes.
Are you talking so the W. The Bush?
Were,
the W.
The George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. So that the rich were paying a higher percentage of the overall tax take. But then you look at who gets the absolute biggest amount. Well, it's usually the rich. They have the most income. Marco Rubio made that point. And then you have to look at the distribution of the different tax rates. And, you know, there's like 19 of them. So I don't think we have time to go through them here. Overall, tax, you know, most people don't pay income taxes. And given that, unless you're touching Social Security taxes, you're already starting with basically the most prosperous half of the population. If you give them a tax cut, you're benefiting those people. The other people aren't getting anything out of it.
I mean,
as you move up, you know, the bigger, there's more room to cut taxes at the top because the taxes are higher there.
Let me ask about that in the context of Marco Rubio, because John Harwood went right at him on this, saying, well, you can hear it right here, the exchange.
The Tax Foundation, which was alluded to earlier, scored your tax plan and concluded that you give nearly twice as much of a gain in after-tax income to the top 1% as to people in the middle of the income scale. Since you're the champion of Americans living paycheck to paycheck, don't you have that backward?
No, you're wrong. In fact, the largest after-tax gains is for the people at the lower end of the tax spectrum under my plan.
Maybe everybody's right. I mean, Ronna, as I understand it, Rubio's plan would give more to the poor, but was Harwood right on the middle class and the top, and who gets what under Rubio?
Well, the thing that, I mean, it's incredibly confusing, and, you know, Megan's right in the sense that sometimes with these plans, one benefit cancels out something else. I mean, you have to look at them in total context and very carefully. The two things that I think are important mm-hmm. about what was presented tax-wise are the fact that lowering taxes in general does not spur growth, and growth is what we need right now. I mean, we are in a 2% economy, not enough, you know, dream world 4% economy, like Jeb Bush would have us believe is possible. And
or
none
Trump,
of the tax
what
plans,
would it take, 6 or 8?
Oh my God, yeah, don't even get me started with that.
Yep.
So none of these plans are going to bolster growth. None of these plans are also going to reduce
the deficit.
You
say that like you're
so
God
kind of
speaking.
A
lot of Republicans say they will, but you're saying it's been proven out by experience?
Yeah, I cited some evidence mm-hmm. earlier. You know, the Bush two tax cuts did not help growth. Tax cuts that have been done under the Obama administration have not helped growth. What helps growth is the underlying macro situation in a country. Okay, this kind of mythology that we can just make growth happen by manipulating the tax code is, I think, wrong.
Andrew in Nashville. Andrew, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Yeah, what'd you see?
Well, and I got to tell you, you know, coming from a perspective of a younger conservative who actually, my girlfriend is a Democrat and we both watched the debate together, we both came out on the same page that Marco Rubio took that whole show and took it for himself.
Exactly, you know, why, Andrew? Why? What convinced you and your Democrat girlfriend?
Right. Well, you know, the thought was going in, you know, I've never had enormous fondness for Bush, but, and that's being on the more conservative end of things, having seen a couple ads that he had put out beforehand detailing his record out in Florida, you know, I came in with more of a positive expectation for him that he might perform well. But when he performed against Rubio and started hammering him with some of those personal attacks, it didn't come across to me in any way as benefiting him at all. And then Rubio's response, I think he just took him out. It was a nail in the coffin.
Marco Rubio, very fluid last night, very, very facile and quick on his feet. He was prepared there, Rachel Smolkin. He clearly foresaw what was going to be coming at him and was sort of loaded for bear and very light on his feet in response. I don't know if we're at a tipping point on Carson and Trump here. Neither of them really, really shining bright last night. But is he the guy to step up if they're off their peak?
It was clearly Marco Rubio's night, and he's been steadily rising and getting more attention. He really broke through last night. Now, we don't know coming out of this exactly what happens next. Trump and Carson didn't need to necessarily break through in the same way last night. They're already getting all of the attention. They're already the two front runners by far. So they may not have needed the kind of performance that Rubio had last night, but certainly a great night for Rubio. As you said, fast on his feet, looked so comfortable up there, and he managed to fire back without putting down anyone else on stage, which made him look very much more positive. Like, he could be this younger candidate of hope while others were squabbling. So he turned that in a positive way for himself as well.
Here's Carson. One more little bit. Tithe, 10%. Will that cover it? Came the question. You said no here.
The rate is going to be much closer to 15%. You also have to get rid of all the deductions and all the loopholes. You also have to do some strategic cutting in several places.
The soft-spoken Ben Carson. Megan, can he hold up those poll numbers with that kind of vigory?
I don't know. I mean, I was watching this. He looked like almost confused. Like, he didn't quite know what he was
doing. Don't be snarky now. A lot of people in the poll.
No, I say that as, like, the guy's a brilliant neurosurgeon. He's obviously not an idiot, right? That doesn't mean that you're good at necessarily that debate format. Lincoln Chafee was an okay senator and an okay governor, and he also didn't really come off as very confident on stage.
Hey, Rana, was it Donald Trump right? Did John Kasich, you know, calling others out on crazy fantasy, did he balance his Ohio budget on fracking, or was that a Trumpism?
I think that's a Trumpism. And, you know, actually, I think Kasich got the story he was telling about Ohio and the growth there was a kind of a half story. I mean, you know, certainly some of the policies that he took were responsible for growth in Ohio. But what's interesting, he was talking again about, you know, the sort of traditional Republican cut taxes, cut red tape. That's what creates growth.
Yep.
Well, actually, if you look at what happened in Ohio, Columbus, Ohio has created the largest chunk of new jobs in Ohio since the big financial crisis and Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And they had a Democratic four-term mayor who went to a bunch of Republican city fathers and said, we need a tax hike, and then we're going to invest that money in infrastructure and training and renovation of the downtown. And that's why that city grew, and that's the biggest chunk of new jobs in Ohio. So kind of not quite the full story.
Well, you guys are really great. I think we've taken a little bit of a Wild West show in Colorado and pulled the substance out of it very nicely, and I'm so grateful to all three of you for helping us do that. Megan McArdle at Bloomberg View, thank you very much for joining us today. Rana Faruhar, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, hello, Rana, thank you. And Rachel Smoke at CNN
thank
Politics.
You for having us.
Thanks to all three of you. You're really terrific. Listeners, we'll keep watching. We'll keep reading all of your comments online, on Twitter at On Point Radio. On Facebook, the same. It's all there for you. You can continue this conversation right there. Be the first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests at our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit that like button. You'll get our alerts on upcoming shows right there in your news feed. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.